History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we want to hear, stories that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot, don't we? We're educated, entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I did say education, and that has been the life's work of George Wicks here in Eugene, Oregon. But we're going to talk about before he was teaching classes, when he was working in the military in World War II, in something called the OSS. And if you're a regular listener, you've heard about that before, but maybe you haven't, and we're going to learn today from 96-year-old George Wicks in Eugene, Oregon. You didn't grow up here, though, George. Rochester, New York. What was your childhood like there in upstate New York?
I had a wonderful childhood, actually. My grandmother had a farm out in the country, and I loved it. I spent a lot of time there. We lived in a suburban neighborhood. We knew all the neighbors. My father had chickens and goats and a garden and very nice childhood. I hated the climate, though. Freezing cold, all your extremities froze in the winter, and then torrid heat in the summer.
And I'm thinking of my brother and my nephews who live in Quebec City, and French was my nephew's first language. And French was your first language there in Rochester? Why was that?
My mother was Belgian. My father had joined the Hoover Commission for Relief in Belgium in 1915, and as soon as he arrived in Belgium, he met my mother and fell in love. There was a war going on, however, and a German occupation in Belgium, so it was 5 years before they got married. But they didn't decide immediately where they were going to live, but they decided if they lived in Europe, they would speak English in the family, because my mother had gone to school in England for a year and spoke English quite well. Or if they ended up in this country, in the U.S., they would make French the language of the family, and we always spoke French at home.
I'm always fascinated by the origin stories, and so what you're telling me is it took World War I for you to be born.
That's right. That's what I said when I taught this seminar on the First World War. I said, First World War is why I'm here.
Well, and of course, at the time they called that the war to end all wars. Did your father ever talk to you much when you were growing up about what he had been through over there?
He talked more about his experience with the Commission for Relief in Belgium, which he worked with for 2 years. Then the U.S. entered the war, and he joined the American Army and served in American headquarters in Paris, mostly. He did see combat, because one of his jobs was escorting big shots to see the war. He said it was kind of a tourist bureau that he was running. Well, he was a modest man, and he wasn't exaggerating. But he talked a lot about the CRB, as they called it, the Commission for Relief in Belgium, and all his friends and their experiences, you know, during the occupation of Belgium by Germany.
So many of the World War II veterans I talked to really didn't see the war coming. Maybe they knew there were some things happening around the world, but they were caught off guard in 1941. Was it different for you? Did you have more of a feel? Was what was happening in Europe more on your radar because of your folks' backgrounds?
Yes, they were keenly aware of what was going on in Europe, and as a consequence, so were their children. You know, I can remember from childhood hearing Hitler's speeches and seeing newsreels of what was going on in Europe. And Belgians naturally were afraid that Germany was going to start another invasion. So they were very, very conscious. And then we visited my Belgian grandparents several times when I was a child. So we were very much in touch with what was going on in the family in France and Belgium.
Was that to the degree that was even unsettling for you, that the future seemed uncertain because of what was happening over there?
Not unsettling to me personally, but very disturbing to my parents. And then we were also conscious of pro-German activity in Rochester, which had a large German population. The German-American Bund was active there, and I remember seeing their signs.
And that's something that we don't hear about too much anymore. It's a chapter that I think most of us would like to forget, but maybe it's important for us to understand that that was really happening here, that before America was in the war, I don't know if everyone knew who was on whose side.
Yes, I think Rochester had a large European population, mostly Italians, but a considerable German and Polish population. So, and they were close enough to the old countries that they had a stronger sense of what was going on in Europe than would be true all across America.
Well, I guess I should ask too, you mentioned, you know, that French was your first language. How old were you when you had to pick up English and had to operate in English?
I had to learn English when I went to kindergarten, and I went with a kid up the street. We used to walk to school. It was about a half mile to school where we went to kindergarten, and he was my translator, my interpreter. The teacher would call on me, and I could understand. I couldn't speak English, but I could understand, and Louis Troiano would answer for me, until finally one day the teacher said, "No, I want him to answer." And that was a painful moment.
Well, maybe that was the first step right there toward you being an English professor for most of your adult life, huh?
I don't think in kindergarten I had the ambition to be an English professor.
Well, that's one of the questions I like to ask. What were your ambitions? I mean, does a kid in Rochester, New York in the 20s and 30s dream about what may happen someday, what I'm going to do with my life?
I don't know at what stage I was well aware that I was going to be in the Army. The war was coming on as I was growing up. So I knew that I wasn't going to be going on to a career, a civilian career, but rather into some military activity of some sorts. I knew that for quite a few years. In fact, when I was in college in Toronto, I drilled in the Canadian Officer Training Corps. I have a picture of myself in a Canadian uniform.
I don't want to forget either to at least cover a little bit of the Great Depression, because it seems to have sparked a lot of memories that stick with people. How did you experience those difficult economic times?
It was a very worrying time for my parents. My father had an illness, too, that demoralized him. And funds were short, you know. We were very keenly aware of the Depression. People would sell apples for 5 cents. Can you imagine paying 5 cents for an apple? It was incredible. I used to walk home from school 5 miles to save the nickel car fare. See, that's the way I earned 5 cents, walking 5 miles.
Different times, for sure. You mentioned going to college at the University of Toronto. Is that where you were when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor?
Yes, that's right. And there were quite a few Americans in the college that I attended. And we were all listening to the radio, you know, when Pearl Harbor was attacked. And we knew we were in for it. We were already training with the Canadian Army, you see. And Canada was at war. We were very conscious of the oncoming war with Germany, at least. And then when Pearl Harbor was attacked, we knew it was going to be bigger than that.
So for you personally, what was that implication? Did you think about joining up right then, or that maybe you'd be drafted soon? Or how did that work for you personally?
Well, each draft board had its own way of dealing with draftees, people of draft age. And in my case, they gave college deferments. They wanted to keep people in college for a time at least. And when I, you know, when I was prepared to be drafted, when I went to the draft board and said, "I'm ready to join now," they said, "Well, no, wait, our quota is filled at the moment." They always had to fill a certain quota. So that way I was deferred for a couple of years, actually.
So what changed? When did that come to an end or take a turn on you?
Well, finally their quota was filled, so they took me. It was as simple as that.
And did you have an idea of how you thought that might go or how you wanted it to go?
I didn't have a very clear idea. I knew I was going to be in the Army. Didn't know exactly what would happen. And in fact, when you joined the Army, when you went to an induction center, you didn't know what was going to happen to you. And they kept you in the dark. And you didn't know until the day your name was called that you were going somewhere, but you didn't know where. They kept you in the dark.
How did your folks handle that? Because obviously your father had some Army experience, but you're the only boy in the family. Were there some emotions wrapped up in your becoming part of the military?
I was named after my mother's youngest brother, who was killed in the First World War. He enlisted the day the Germans invaded Belgium. He was 17 years old, and he served at the front until the last year of the war, and then he was killed. Germans invaded Belgium on August 4th, 1914. I was drafted on August 4th, 1942. You can imagine what this meant to my mother. My father never talked much about his military experience. It was, well, he did, but he was not a frontline soldier, so he didn't see action except as a spectator.
So you're in the Army now, and I mentioned that acronym OSS, but there were another four letters that became part of your reality, ASTP. And that sounded like a pretty good deal, didn't it? The Army Specialized Training Program?
Yes, but you didn't apply for it. They picked you for it. And I didn't know I was going into ASTP. First, I went to infantry basic training. And all the time I was at Fort Benning, Georgia, I had no idea where I would be going next. As I say, the Army kept you guessing. In fact, after basic training, after 13 weeks in Georgia, place planted in poison ivy, they put a bunch of us on a train and didn't tell us where we were going. And we were on the train for at least a week with no idea where we were going. Nobody explained anything. And we landed in a place called Berkeley, California. And the guys who had qualified in German were told they were going to study Chinese. And the guys who qualified in French were told they would study Vietnamese, which made some kind of sense, contrary to Army logic. Since it was French Indochina, where French was spoken by not only the French, but any of the educated Vietnamese and even ordinary Vietnamese. They worked in French, yes.
So your first year in the Army, you're in Berkeley, really as a college student, as part of the Army, studying Vietnamese specifically, and that's it?
I was in heaven. 1943, I landed at Berkeley on, you know, this beautiful place. I fell in love with it. At that time, the population of UC Berkeley was only 8,000, almost all civilians, most of them girls, of course. It was a very nice place to be. And we were in uniform, and we had a little drill, but not much military action, no military training. We'd already had that, actually. And we lived in a fraternity house and took classes. That's what we were doing. We were students. This is the Army Specialized Training Program, ASTP.
Of course, there came an end. There came a point when that was too good to be true, and bodies were needed elsewhere. How was your experience interrupted, or what was the point where you found out this isn't the way it's always going to be?
I always knew it wasn't going to be like that forever, but it went on for 9 months. I went 3 semesters before I was interviewed by a major from an organization called OSS. I had taken a test that showed I was qualified. I had skills that would be useful in cryptography. So the OSS recruited me. I could have stayed at Berkeley another, if I'd been spared, you see, if I'd been overlooked, I could have spent another 3 delightful months at Berkeley.
What, if anything, did you know about the OSS and what it was all about?
I knew nothing about OSS, but once I was in Washington, D.C., I found out exactly what it was and what it was like. I was chiefly in the communications end of things. I was trained in cryptography and started working as a cryptographer while in Washington.
Well, flesh that out for us. What does that mean? If you're working as a cryptographer, what are you doing from the start of that shift to the end? What kind of work and what was the impact or significance of it?
You're encoding and decoding secret messages that are being sent wherever OSS has units operating. That's your daily activity.
Technology in the 1940s was a little different from here in the 21st century. So what kind of equipment or technology did you have at your disposal?
Well, we had, you know, radio existed.
Yeah.
Telegraph existed. There was immediate communication. You could send a message to Calcutta, for instance, from Washington, D.C., and expect an answer if it was urgent in a matter of minutes. So the communication was very efficient. There wasn't any problem. Now, when you were communicating with people in the field, as you were more likely to do overseas, then there was always a problem. And when we were in Saigon, particularly when we were the one day when we were besieged, it was very difficult to get communications, but finally the radio communications with the British is what saved us.
That sounds like a story we need to hear, doesn't it? And by the time this hour is up, we most certainly will. 96-year-old George Wicks of Eugene, Oregon is our guest today. Find photos and a short video of Professor Wicks online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.